Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Street versus Pilgrim.
May it please the court, Mr. John Thomas will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, as with the prior case, this case also involves the question of first impression under Texas law. At issue is the scope of so-called liability under a ranger liability under the Texas Solid Waste Disposal Act. That's the analog of CERCLA, and before the court is a handout that was provided with statutory references. Under Section 271A3, a party is responsible for solid waste if, by contract, agreement, or otherwise, arranged to process, store, or dispose of solid waste. We believe that the Court of Appeals made two fundamental errors in this case when it came to the application of this standard. The first error was the actual legal test that the court applied. The court articulated a test of control, that is, a party must control the waste disposal decisions at a solid waste facility. However, in application of that standard, the court departed from the articulated test and used one of a nexus alone. That is, the Court of Appeals looked for whether or not my client, R.R. Street, had any nexus with the waste disposal activities of Pilgrim in this case. As a consequence of a finding of nexus by the trial court, by the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals concluded that R.R. Street was responsible for solid waste as a matter of law.
There are a number of tests out there. Look at the different courts around the country. Obligation to exercise control, authority to control, active involvement. What's the appropriate test? Do you criticize the Court of Appeals' test of control?
The test of control, Your Honor, would be an appropriate test. The question is one of application. You are correct, Justice Wainwright, that in all the CERCLA cases that are out there, there's a variety of tests that have been articulated. What we have done in our brief is try to provide the court with a survey of relevant CERCLA case law. And what you will see running through all the tests, all the cases under CERCLA, is a question of obligation or one of authority. The courts have held that when you're relying upon obligation, you have to have some active involvement with the disposal of solid waste. On the other hand, authority alone to control would be sufficient under many CERCLA cases. So the standard that we've articulated, which would be appropriate under Texas law, is the question, did R.R. Street, in this case, arrange to process, control, or arrange to dispose of solid waste at the facility? And the instruction would be that a person arranges to dispose of solid waste if they had the obligation to control and exercise some active involvement with the waste disposal decisions, or alternatively, had the authority to dispose of solid waste at the facility. In this case, Pilgrim articulates or argues that the policy of broadly reading this statute is applicable. We say that is not the case.
What if they don't have the obligation or the authority to dispose of solid waste, but they actually do? They take control.
Your Honor, clearly under the statute that if you own or possess solid waste, then that may be a theory of liability. But if one does not own or possess the waste, which in this case is the situation with R.R. Street,
well,
if you do not own or possess the waste, then you have to have some authority to control or obligation plus involvement.
But Corbin possessed a certain amount. You don't dispute that. You claim it's the price amount or the domestic sewage exclusion.
Justice O'Neill, you are correct that that would be an alternative basis of liability that requires separate examination. And yes, it's a question of de minimis quantities, but we, if you go back to the statute, our response to that issue is that that is also not a basis for our liability under the Act because, number one, there was no disposal, and number two, it would not be solid waste under the Act because of the domestic sewage exclusion that you referenced.
Why would it not be disposed?
If you reference down to the definition of disposal on the sheet that we provided, a disposal is a dumping, spilling, leaking, etc., into land or water. This was deposited into a sewer. One of the very basic issues in this case, and one of the reasons that the Court of Appeals got around the domestic sewage exclusion, is their conclusion on appeal that the sewer pipes leaked. As we pointed out in the briefing, our jury verdict, defense verdict, was affirmed, and the court reviewed the evidence and said there was substantial evidence upon which a jury could conclude that materials dumped in the sewer did not leak and cause environmental contamination. So we have a real dispute of fact issue in this case as to whether the sewer pipes leaked. And so we have asked the court to render in our favor. However, that is one of the issues that would be applicable if there is a retrial, and that would be the question of the applicability of the domestic sewage exclusion.
Just to understand it, would disposal down a drain, let's assume no leak, there'd be no regulation under the Act for disposal of solid waste down a drain? It's got to be directly on the land or water.
Well, Justice Jefferson, there is a large body of regulations that addresses that issue. There are substantial regulations as what you can and cannot put into the sewer. POTWs, publicly owned treatment works that receive the waste and treat it, have requirements for what you can put into it. Sometimes too much chemicals will affect the microbes that deal with the waste that goes to the system. So there is a regulatory framework that deals with this. I think the question here is there any CERCLA-type remedy under the Texas Solid Waste Disposal Act because something was deposited into the sewer? Our contention is there is not, and that is supported by the literal language of the statute, which incorporates both on its face the domestic sewage exclusion from RCRA, the statute, and the regulatory domestic exclusion, regulatory exclusion that's been promulgated by EPA. Furthermore, it's in the second part of the definition as well. If you look down at 003 in the definition section number 34, it says it's subject to both of the exclusions that I just mentioned, and then it says it specifically does not include solid waste or dissolved material in domestic sewage.
Let me ask you. I just don't want to look back at the transcript and be confused. In your brief, you say that the tests are there are two from the federal cases. One is authority and involvement, and the second one is obligation. And I thought I heard you say here that it was obligation and involvement, and the second one was authority. So getting confused on the elements.
Well, I may have to go back and look at the brief, Justice Hack. I thought it was obligation plus some involvement.
It says, authority. No federal court has imposed ranger liability on a party who did not have, one, the authority to dispose of waste as well as some actual involvement in its disposal, or two, the obligation to dispose of the waste.
I stand corrected.
You're with the brief.
I am with
right,
the brief.
Good.
Got a little confused with my coffee this morning, I suppose. But it's important with regard to the domestic sewage exclusion to understand what the Court of Appeals did on this fact issue. The EPA says the domestic sewage exclusion applies from the moment materials are deposited into the sewer if they will ultimately mix with domestic sewage. The Court of Appeals relied upon the Lincoln Properties case in California for the proposition that the domestic sewage exclusion didn't apply in this case. That case, it was undisputed as to whether the sewer pipes leaked. And the Court of Appeals concluded that since the sewer pipes leaked, no matter what reading of the domestic sewage exclusion you had, it was inapplicable in this case. So number one, our contention on appeal to this court is that the domestic sewage exclusion on its face makes the materials deposited into the sewer by Mr. Corbin not solid waste. So it's exempt from the statute and the cost recovery elements of the statute. And number two, if the court does determine that there is a fact issue to be determined on this question, that should be in the remand order back to the trial court. Specifically, did Pilgrim establish that it was solid waste, because it's our contention that it's their burden. I might mention one other thing with regard to this, and it is de minimis. This is a 1 1/4 vial, 1 1/4 cc vial of perchloroethylene that's used to test the detergent. I think the court can take judicial notice that the cap to your mechanical pencil is about 1 cc. The evidence in the case is that one spill at a Pilgrim facility was about 75 gallons of pure perchloroethylene. We think that the evidence at trial, the basis for the jury finding in our favor that R.R. Street was not responsible for the contamination at these sites, was the handling practices and the negligence of Pilgrim in dealing with the solvent, not the activities of a vendor and a salesperson who visits the plant on occasion. Moving back to one of the basic starting points.
But can't the jury take that into account under the present posture of the case and award them? I mean, couldn't they? Liability's been established as an arranger, but in determining, is the jury going to enforce that? Could come up with de minimis?
Well, as you know, that's one of the factors in the Court of Appeals remand order, to look at the volume and the activities of the parties involved.
So why doesn't that solve the problem?
Well, it doesn't solve the problem for two reasons. One is, on the face of the statute, you have to get around what the language of the statute says to reach that conclusion, in our opinion. And secondly, in the context of these CERCLA actions, for somebody who has little or no responsibility with the decisions with regard to solid waste, are we going to have a policy that imposes liability no matter what and put somebody to actual trial of the case to have to come up and defend themselves before a jury can make findings upon which a judge can then apportion?
Well, but apart from the, just put a fine point on it, apart from the de minimis aspect of it, if you apply the test that you say should apply, certainly Corbin had the authority to dump the vial down the sink and he was actually involved in that, so he would meet that test as an arranger.
Well,
with respect to the vial.
Your Honor, this would be that he actually owned or possessed, is what your point is, and that while we did raise this issue about whether he performed the test, it was actually on behalf of Pilgrim and with their authority. I think the answer to your question is yes, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals found, and the argument was that he actually possessed a de minimis quantity of solid waste and didn't make an arrangement for its disposal, but actually disposed of. So it wouldn't fit the language or otherwise arranged to dispose of solid waste, that he actually did the disposal himself.
Does the record reflect how much the cleaning establishment disposed of, the volume over the years?
Your Honor, the record is replete with a variety of information about how they disposed of. Beginning in the mid-1980s with the hazardous waste regulations, waste products from the dry cleaner were taken away by a hazardous waste hauling facility. Prior to that time, materials were deposited into the trash because there was no other way to deal with them.
But is there any indication of volume, like gallons?
Yes, Your Honor. There are substantial indications of volumes, which would include principally the issues of how much was contained in spills, how much was spilled during delivery, how much was spilled during ruptured tanks, how much volume was contained in the waste products themselves. Yes.
And with respect to Corbin, evidence that he disposed of these 1 1/4 cc vials thousands of times, which over 40 years would maybe be a gallon or so.
Well, I don't think we quantified that at trial to how much that came up with, but there is contradicting evidence to that, Your Honor. That was you have to remember there were numerous plants, both in San Antonio and Houston. This test was performed on an 8 to 10 week basis as he would visit the plants. But then when the hazardous waste regulations came into place in the mid-1980s, the materials were deposited into the hazardous waste bin. Mr. Corbin's successor, Mr. Thumb, actually testified at trial that he was taught to pour it in the hazardous waste bin by Mr. Corbin himself. Mr. Corbin contradicted that testimony at trial.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear your argument.
May it please the court, Mr.
first by suggesting that the court's decision in this case today is going to extend beyond private parties, Pilgrim suing Street for contribution. This statute is quite wide-ranging, and it includes responsible parties in several of its sections. What the court decides today is going to affect who the state can include in its cleanup efforts, who the state can sue to recover, who innocent landowners who purchase property can sue to recover, as innocent landowners have responsibility for sites, even though they purchased them and are purely innocent. And so the statute itself uses responsible parties in various different contexts, various different remedial and administrative provisions of the statute. I want to talk about the test that's applied. Street, in its brief, all of the federal courts that address this, the question under CERCLA, and the Court of Appeals, acknowledge that there isn't a test for arranger status, or actually for responsible parties in general. It's a multi-factor analysis. It's a totality of the circumstances to the extent that there's a test, that is the test. These cases, if you read these thousands of CERCLA cases that are out there, there are myriad of circumstances and relationships among parties that the courts consider. This is an equitable remedial statute that is designed to look at and consider and result in some equitable, fair result in those myriad of circumstances. A bright line test doesn't suit that sort of remedial, equitable analysis and result. Because when you have a bright line rule, there are always cases inside or outside.
Got to look to something.
Well, I think you do, Your Honor. And all of these cases give you factors that you look to. And when we come to that, I think that what you are asking, Judge Heck, is in part something that I want you to focus on. Because most of the case law that exists out there focuses first on people who have actual involvement in the waste disposal decision. That is at the core of CERCLA. It doesn't then require on top of that an obligation or authority. Where the courts move to obligation or authority is when you don't have actual involvement in the waste disposal. We've cited some of the cases in our brief. There are numerous others, but that is the way. I mean, I can
read you another one. So if you're just sitting around the dinner table and one guy says, well, how do you do it? And he says, well, I just dumped out the sink. Would that be enough involvement?
I think absolutely it would. Why shouldn't it be, Your Honor? I mean, to say that someone who pumps it into the sewer or who pours it down a drain, who pours it down a toilet, industrial waste, who is disposing of it down a toilet, down a drain, into the sewer, that is not disposal, I think that would astonish the legislature.
Well, no, I mean, it's certainly bad conduct on his part to do that, but then is he also liable for just sort of musing that to someone else that he does that, to clean up their stuff?
I don't think that's what we have here. I mean, whether that would be enough.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
In some cases,
how casual does the contact have to be before there's actual involvement?
I think that's why you have a case-by-case analysis.
Well, I understand that, but it can't be left up to the predilection of the judge. We've got to be guided by some rule that tells us over in this area that's enough and over here it's not enough.
No, I mean, I think there are always going to be hard cases, and there are obviously going to be cases that fall at one end of the spectrum or another. I mean, and you can look at, there are certainly cases that are out there where people are not held to be arrangers. There are lots of cases where people are held to be arrangers. I think that courts do look at these factors and what all is there.
What are the factors that you said? You should look at factors, and you said primary among them is actual involvement.
Absolutely.
And what else?
Well, in this case, I think that the factors that the court ought to consider are the principal factors. First, that Corbin was present for over 4 decades on a weekly basis in these plants, repeatedly. He was there virtually on a weekly basis in Pilgrim's plant in Houston and in San Antonio. And what he did while he was there in those plants was that he performed tests, himself. He took possession of PCE contaminants, and he physically dumped it down the drain. He did that absolutely with permission, absolutely open. No one, he had the actual authority to do that. He had the apparent authority to do that, and he did it.
Tiny amount.
A tiny amount that can...
Maybe a gallon over the whole...
And it contaminates 200 million gallons of groundwater.
Was there evidence of direct leaks from the one, from the pipes?
There is evidence in the record of leaks from those pipes. Your Honor, there is.
What if there were not? What if the evidence was undisputed that the contamination did not...
I get that perhaps that would be some harder question, but whether or not he's, I think that then switches over to him to prove. I mean, there, whether you're responsible.
If there was evidence of leaks, then why did the jury, didn't the jury say there was fine against you when they said Street didn't create a nuisance on the property?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it's just like any other cause of action. I don't know why the jury decided. But there are any number of instructions that go with nuisance that can be.
Well, I assume we could. Judge Jefferson couldn't have found as a matter of law that these vials actually leaked because nobody ever traced vials.
No, that's not required
if it's possible that these vials leaked out of pipes, possible not, why doesn't the jury's no on the nuisance question settle that?
Because that's not a jury question, and it wasn't. That's not even what the jury was asked in the nuisance question. So, I mean, I think to say that you're going to
substantially interferes with the use and enjoyment of land. I mean, this was all about contamination of land, right?
Yes, but there are lots of issues that go into that nuisance question. There are lots of issues that go into the negligence and the products questions. We don't normally take the jury's answers to one set of questions and say, okay, well, you answered them that way, so that means, therefore, that these other issues that were resolved differently by either the jury on a different question or a judge on a different question are somehow now determined by the jury's contrary answers on other issues and other questions.
I guess, but the import of my question is there a causative element to determining a ranger status?
No, there's not.
It would not matter then whether or not it was disputed or undisputed that a leak generated sewer pipes to determine as law, ranger status.
That's absolutely correct.
But that would come out on the damages and causation apportionment.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. That's the way this statute is set up. That's the way it works. And I want
if we're going to look at actual involvement, and that seems to be the principal factor outlined so far, because there's no question the corporate was present. Is that a fact question?
No, I don't believe that is a fact question.
Can't ever be, or just not in this case?
Well, I think it's not in this case. I think if Mr. Corbin, for example, had said, I wasn't there, then that would be that, and we said, oh, yes, you were, that could become a fact question that the jury might have to resolve before the judge could make a decision. But in this case, I mean, we're talking about only undisputed facts. And I want to go, I mean, I think that what Corbin did while he was there in terms of physically dumping those individual vials, it's only a small part of what he did and what the personal involvement was. This is a man, as I said, who was there on a weekly basis. This was by far his biggest client. And he was hugely profitable to Street because of how much he did with Pilgrim. But what he did with waste was he came in, and the evidence is undisputed that he gave specific disposal instructions. He came in and he told Pilgrim's employees in these various plants, he told them that the way to dispose of separator water, which contains PCE, was to dump it down the drain.
But they didn't have to believe it. They didn't have to believe it. Is that true?
Well, of course they didn't have to believe him, but he knew that they did believe him. He knew and testified that Pilgrim both considered him to be the expert and that they took his advice and that he knew that they were taking his advice and instructions. And that was the way that they were supposed to dispose of the waste. He was in their plants telling them what to do. He saw that they were doing it. He knew that they considered him to be a person who was there to give them that kind of advice and was an expert on those matters, and that they were taking that advice.
So if a lawyer advised him that it's okay to do that, I've looked at the statute, pouring it into domestic sewage is all right, then the lawyer would be in range.
A lawyer might be, but I think it takes, for one thing, it takes a physical presence. I can't, I mean, whether we're going to, I think think it depends on what that lawyer's relationship was, if he was present at the site.
Why does it matter if he's there every day or just told them what to do and they followed his instructions for 40 years?
Well, I it may be that even if he hadn't been there, that it would be enough that they followed his instructions for 40 years. But I do think that it adds to the totality of the circumstances that he was present there. He saw that they were following his instructions. He knew continuously. And over time, he repeated those instructions and told them to keep doing this. He was doing this for products that, if they talk about only being a seller, he was doing this as to wastewater that came from products that Street didn't sell. He's talking about things that are sold by other people and what to do with the waste that comes from those products.
Ms. Hogan, you said two of the factors are actual involvement and presence. I got the impression that you have other factors.
I think it's the totality. Moving beyond that, in this case, I do think it's an important factor that he knew that Street intended that its people like Mr. Corbin actually have the physical presence, that they actually go there and develop the relationship of confidence and being the expert and being the vice president of a Pilgrim's cleaning operation. I think that's a very important fact in this case to look at. I think it's a very important fact that Corbin himself knew that he was being relied on, that he had complete access to the plant, that he didn't have to get permission from anyone anytime he arrived at the plant. I think it's an important fact in this case that every disposal decision that was made, Corbin played a role in.
Is it appropriate to remand for a separate trial on damage?
As a general proposition, we know what the rule says. No, in this case, I don't think that liability in a sense is contested. And I think we've laid out in the brief why it's not contested. This is a case in which the statutory interpretation question, much like a duty question, is a question of law. And the facts are undisputed. When that goes back, it would be law of the case. We don't send back a duty determination. We don't send back a statutory interpretation question and say that it's for the courts, the lower court, to be able to open that up and look at it again. Here, the facts that determine whether or not Street is an arranger, we say, are facts, and the Court of Appeals have, those facts are all undisputed.
When the federal courts and other courts have used the idea of obligation to control waste disposal in this context, do you argue that Street had such an obligation?
Well, I think it's very difficult to say, and I would ask, what does authority or obligation mean? I mean, we certainly have undertaking. We certainly recognize undertaking duties in Texas, and the federal courts say that it's sometimes appropriate to look at general sort of tort law principles in order to determine these things. Street certainly came in and undertook to provide specific advice on how to dispose of filters and muck and the separator water. And I would say that it has an obligation.
Having undertaken that much, it had an obligation to do it right.
It had an obligation to do it right. Absolutely. We would. And the same with authority. I mean, no one at trial or at any time has said that Mr. Corbin did not have the authority to pour the stuff down the drain, to give instructions on how all of this waste disposal was to occur. No one said he was acting ultra vires. Street didn't claim that he didn't have the authority to do these things on their behalf. Quite the contrary. Street's president and one of Street's vice presidents, they offered their testimony at the trial that that's what all of their people were doing, that they knew that those instructions were being provided. So Street never claimed that he lacked the authority to do these things.
Let's talk about the limits of your actual involvement test. Let's go back to the dinner table. The guy says, I'll just pour my vial down the sink. What if he then says, an expert at a conference I went to last week told me that that's the way to do it, and I'm going to do it. Is the expert at that conference also going to be liable?
I think if you pull one fact out, Judge, it's really it's very difficult to say. I think I'm certainly willing to say that if, there are plenty of courts around the country that have said that if all you do is send an MSDA could read those, see what they look like, come line that up versus what happened in this case. But if what you, if all you do is you supply a product, and with that product you see, send an MSDS sheet or some instruction, I think most courts have come to the conclusion that if that is the extent of the involvement, then you aren't an arranger. I don't have a problem with that.
We're struggling with where that extent is, because we're not in the habit of imposing millions of dollars of liability on people without knowing kind of in the ballpark where the line is.
Well, I think the only way that you can get some comfort there probably is to read this body of case law that's out there.
Well, that's why I'm hoping to get comfort from you. Obviously, have read it, and so I'm hoping against hope you'll distill it for us here.
Well, I am trying to tell you that we're at the core of that. That I don't think we're anywhere close to the outside edge in this case. Not when you look at the actual physical presence and involvement.
And I think we understand that, Ms. Hogan. We're trying to figure out if we go the direction you're going, where is it going to take us? This case is important. We've got to be concerned about the ramifications of it as well. Take another example. Corbin tells an employee at Pilgrim, just dump those vials in the sink, I'm going to lunch. That employee, let's say he's an employee from FedEx, he's delivering a box. Corbin says, dump those vials in the sink. They happen to be there every week at the same time for a year. FedEx guy does that every week for a year while Corbin goes to lunch. Where does your totality of the circumstances take us there?
For FedEx? Or for
FedEx. Okay. Well, I know where you are on Corbin.
Right. Well, I mean, but in your hypothetical, I mean, Corbin, we don't know what else Corbin did there. FedEx, I would probably say that courts could go either way and have gone either way. I mean, if somebody who comes physically dumps things onto the ground, into the drains, it doesn't take anything beyond that. I would say, in most circumstances, in the cases that I've seen, I mean, people who spill it. If you're just a transporter, if you're a motor carrier, but if you spill the stuff, then you know the person who hired you may not be liable, and the person who you're coming to may not be liable, but because you did it, you are. So I would say most courts would say FedEx is liable.
Domestic sewage exception.
Well, I'd say the domestic sewage exclusion. I think there are three arguments that we have. The first one is, of course, that what is expressly included within the definition are hazardous substances, and that is what this is. So if you have some broad general exclusion of domestic sewage, hazardous substances are absolutely brought back in for purposes of these specific cost recovery statutes sections. Secondly, the exclusion itself, the broad federal exclusion that is talked about, comes with the limitations that exist under federal law. And once you bring in the federal exclusion, the federal exclusion only goes so far. The federal exclusion only applies to the RCRA, and it applies to the record-keeping sections, and that's the exclusion that Texas imported. So the only thing they imported was a limited exclusion, and it ought to have the exact same limitations in Texas. And finally, I'd say this is a statutory interpretation question in which we're trying to discern the legislature's intent. And I would say it absolutely cannot be the legislature's intent, and they would be astonished to learn that when you write this opinion and you say that the domestic sewage exclusion applies, that the next day all any company has to do is pour its waste down the drain or down the toilet.
Mr. Thomas says no, there's other statutes.
What Mr. Thomas said is that there are other statutes that would regulate it, but that there is no remedy, that the state can't come in as a responsible person because it's not disposal, and that the state can't go to and get those people to participate, and that no one else who might own that property could ever come back and do anything against that.
Let me ask you, in terms of the arranger status piece, the Court of Appeals carefully parsed through various things that Street did to determine whether they were enough to establish a ranger status. If one of those is enough, do all of them need to be addressed in terms of the damages piece that's going back? In other words, if the court were to believe that Corbin member or ranger status on street, do you then need to address whether directing them to pour out the separator water also would be enough, whether the rest would be enough, or?
I think any one of those. I think it's wrong to parse them, to take them all apart. Now, I think you're a ranger because of the totality of the circumstances. But any one of those that you want to pick is going to make a street and a ranger on the liability side. What that affects is how the apportionment works, how the damages are going to be determined.
But I guess what I'm saying, if we were to hold that streets and a ranger based on the vials dumped down the sink, but not an arranger as to the separator water directed to be dumped down the sink, doesn't the trial court or the jury need guidance on that piece to determine what sort of damage allocation? We don't need to address them all, terrific, but do we need to, so the trial court will know what to submit to the jury?
I guess there are two ways the court could handle that. One is to say that it addresses one and finds their arranger and leaves the others without comment as to whether it would or would not make them arranger. I think in that circumstance, we'd probably go back to the trial court and it's going to be an issue that's going to come up.
In other words, the trial court's going to have to decide that in submitting the case to the jury.
Right, at least in terms of, because it's going to affect questions of volume and the relationship. I mean, the two issues that the Court of Appeals has identified for the jury, those kinds of questions are going to be important in determining those issues.
The industry is a little worried about your argument that PCE may be a solid waste while it is in use. That's their amicus, Pat Boggs' amicus brief. What's your response to that brief?
I don't think that the industry has any reason to be worried based on the decision that we're asking the court to make.
Well, do you think PCE is a solid waste while it is in use?
No, I don't. I think the waste.
They're afraid that you think that you do. But.
No, and I don't think our brief leads to that result. I don't think the Court of Appeals opinion has led to that result. I think that's going beyond this case.
If on the domestic sewage exclusion, if there were no evidence that the pipes had leaked, would it fit the exclusion? Because the way I understand the cases that have been cited is that as long as the leak is upstream from any sort of mixture with domestic sewage, the exclusion doesn't apply.
I think different courts. I think that the federal courts have taken at least two different approaches to the counterpart of this. I mean, I think that one side says that one of the cases suggests that it isn't a question really whether the pipes leak. At least on the front end of whether you're a ranger, whether you have disposed of the substance, and then there is a release of the substance, that you don't actually have to prove that. They just say the domestic sewage exclusion is not intended to meet these types of industrial waste that are dumped down the toilets or put into the drain. One of the courts does look at this question, and because it's a question where there was no doubt but what it leaked before it moved on. But I don't think, what you won't find is going to be a court that has said that is in and of itself, that because it was poured down the toilet, it's industrial waste poured down the toilet, that meets the domestic sewage exclusion under federal law.
Thank you, counsel.
It's our position that a test that I know it when I see it just won't do for us in this case or for this state. One of the reasons that you have totality of circumstances in the federal court is because there is no right to a jury trial. Litigants in these types of cases do have a right to a jury trial, and we have a right to a jury trial on disputed facts. If the test is one of control, we say that that is certainly a fact issue, and Justice O'Neill, that would make arranger status a fact issue, not a question of law. If we're talking about technical services and advice, and at what stage does that cross the line?
Well, it's undisputed that Corbin disposed of these vials. That would be a matter of law determination on a ranger status, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, you're absolutely right to separate the two. Can I put the Corbin aside just for one moment and go back to the question of technical services and advice?
Well,
because I do think that you need to address absolutely each and every one of these, not only to give us guidance on retrial, but to all litigants. because if it's a question of technical services and advice, the question and the test that we articulate is when does that cross the line between just being a vendor and providing useful information that you want to encourage manufacturers of these products to provide users? And when does that transition into control? We think that that would be a fact issue.
You don't dispute that we could find a ranger status as a matter of law as to some of these pieces, just not all.
I think if you're talking about the question of control, there's pieces of evidence that relate to the question of control. They are technical services and advice. My response to your question is no, you cannot find that as a matter of law. On the other hand, we think that you can rule on this as a matter of law because none of those issues, none of those technical services or advice as a matter of law rise to the level of control in our view. So yes, you can decide that in our favor as a matter of law. If you articulate a test that those may be indicia of control over Pilgrim's solid waste disposal decisions, then that would be a fact issue. Now let me move over to Mr. Portman, because that's completely separate. There will be, and there are fact issues on whether Mr. Corbin's conduct is a disposal. If you rule that he had actual possession, did he dispose? We have to look at the statute. And is it solid waste? We have to look at the definition of it. And to the extent that there is a dispute on sewer pipes leaking, you cannot decide that as a matter of law because there's a dispute and disputed fact question.
Ms. Hogan points out that solid waste does not include domestic sewage, but it does include hazardous substances, and PCE falls under the latter. Is that right? So why do we need to know whether it was domestic sewage or not?
Because in the statute it says hazardous solid waste is trash, rubbish, and other discarded material. That is the definition. The question needs to be, was it discarded material? Then you go on and it says, and adding life to that provision, it does not include domestic sewage, but it does include hazardous substance, but that are otherwise discarded material and subject to the restrictions in the first sentence of the definition.
So what if someone flushed hazardous substances, large amounts, into the sewer system? Are there other remedial provisions that you claim would take care of that?
Well, first of all, if you follow the court's ruling in Lincoln Properties, if there is a leak, the question of the holding in that case is that it doesn't apply. The domestic sewage exclusion doesn't apply. If that's the case, there would be a remedy. However, the way the statute is written is that no matter what, if it's domestic sewage and goes in the sewer, it is not solid waste covered by this act.
So, but why wouldn't someone then just flush everything, presuming no leaks?
Because they'd get busted by the POTW, who would say, putting too much stuff down the drain, stop. That's the short answer to that question. And that
there wouldn't be any money damages.
Pardon?
There wouldn't be any after-the-fact monetary damages in that situation. It's just a regulatory order that you have to cease.
If you do not fit the definition of solid waste, that is correct. There would not be any CERCLA-type contribution action under the statute.
Because under your theory, there wouldn't be contamination.
There wouldn't be solid waste that was disposed of by somebody. So if it's not solid waste and does not fit the definition of solid waste, i.e. it goes into the sewer, which is going to be carried on to a POTW,
it is not
solid waste.
Without a leak.
Our position is both regulations apply. Now, there's one thing I might point out, Justice Owen, with regard to that, is that the EPA has studied this issue since 1984 directive by Congress to look at the question of sewer pipe leakage and whether that presents an environmental hazard. They issued a report in 1986 and entered in 2 or 3 years of rulemaking. And ultimately in 1990 came out with a rule that says we're going to keep this exemption in place regardless of the possibility that it may leak. And our regulatory exemption applies from the moment it's put in the drain, regardless of the leak. Now our legislature in Texas has amended this statute on numerous times since 1985. In light of all that record by EPA, has not changed the definition of solid waste.
Questions. Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the second clause concludes today's arguments. The marshal will adjourn.
All rise.
Okay.